I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. They've won 5 Super Bowls since 2001. They have the best quarterback who ever played the position and a coach who's widely regarded as a football genius, even if he's a bit despised outside of Foxborough. The New England Patriots have established a dynasty as one of the most successful franchises in all of sports, not just football, so it's easy to forget that they haven't been around for very long and that for the lion's share of their existence, they've had about as much success as, well, the Detroit Lions. Now, that team, for those less versed in football lore, has never won a Super Bowl and consistently fields teams that have little chance of doing so. But now a new illustrated history of the New England Patriots, called simply the Pats, brings to life the glorious and decidedly inglorious origins of a team that's gone from pigskin punching bag to perennial powerhouse. Glenn Stout is the author of dozens of sports-related books, including one of my all-time favorites, Red Sox Century, and he co-authored The Pats with Richard A. Johnson, curator of the Sports Museum of New England. Glenn Stout joins me now in our VPR studios to talk about his new book on the Pats. Glenn, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
So, Glenn Stout, for almost 2 decades now, Patriots fans have been spoiled by these Tom Brady-led teams. And the 5 Super Bowls I talked about, they've got all these AFC championships, 8 of those, 9 AFC titles in a row. Give us an idea, though, of the team that was first called the Boston Patriots when they debuted in 1960 and the man who brought them into existence.
Well, the Boston Patriots were the polar opposite of the New England Patriots of recent vintage. The Patriots were founded by Billy Sullivan, who was an oil company executive, former PR man for the Boston Braves, and they were the last team to join the AFL. And in fact, had the AFL not needed an 8th team, they probably wouldn't have gone to Billy Sullivan to put together a package to bring the team in because Billy didn't have any money. But nevertheless, he was able to cobble together 11 investors and slot the Patriots in. And that was part of the problem with the Patriots in their early years, is that Billy really didn't have any money. The Patriots didn't have a place to play. They sometimes played at Old Braves Field, Nickerson Field at BU, sometimes Fenway Park, sometimes Harvard, sometimes Boston College. And, you know, Billy, from the very beginning, he said he didn't want to be a non-entity. Mm. And so by owning the Patriots, it was a way for him to be a big shot. And one of the things he wanted to do to be a big shot was to get a stadium built and then become a big developer. So that was the motivating force for much of the first couple of decades of the Patriots, was to make Billy a lot of money and make Billy a big shot. Unfortunately, he didn't have the money to make a very good team. So the Patriots were quite the laughingstock of the AFL for much of their tenure there.
And the AFL, of course, that was the American Football League, which eventually merged with the NFL. First, it was sort of this upstart league and was kind of taken as a bit of a joke, I guess, until the New York Jets won that Super Bowl, the 3rd Super Bowl.
That's right. The AFL, however, you know, was a very exciting league. It was more wide open than the NFL, a lot less stodgy. And the Patriots kind of fit right in because things could be a little weird. Things could be a little off. And the Patriots were a little off for their first decade.
Now, you write about Sullivan, a very colorful character indeed, having kind of a 6 degrees of separation connection to the man who wrote On the Road. We're talking about Jack Kerouac here. How is one of the most famous members of the Beat Generation even connected to football?
It's one of my favorite stories. You know, in a way, Jack Kerouac is responsible for the Patriots existing because Billy Sullivan worked for Boston College. He worked for Coach Frank Leahy, and they tried to recruit Jack Kerouac out of Lowell High School to play for Boston College.
He was a star football player at Lowell.
And in fact, Billy even spent Thanksgiving dinner with the Kerouac family after Kerouac scored the winning touchdown in the Lowell-Lawrence game. But Jack decided to go to Columbia. In retribution, Billy Sullivan's brother Joe, who was a print shop owner who employed Kerouac's father, fired Leo Kerouac, sent the Kerouac family into disaster. And had that not happened, had Jack gone to Boston College, he might have been a star there. Billy might have followed Frank Leahy to Notre Dame, and the Patriots never would have existed. So, you know, Jack Kerouac is responsible for the Boston Patriots as much as anybody else.
Incredible. When did the team change its name to the New England Patriots, and what drove that decision?
Well, that was like essentially a marketing decision. Billy Sullivan at one point decided he wanted to call the Patriots the Bay State Patriots because they weren't playing in Boston anymore. He'd finally built this very utilitarian stadium in Foxborough that was actually designated for union purposes as a highway because it was essentially an embankment with seats on it. But Billy called them the Bay State Patriots. Well, it took about half a minute for the press to start calling them the BS Patriots, and they didn't mean Billy Sullivan. So the league actually stepped in, Pete Rozelle, and was like, you know what? You're not going to call them the Bay State Patriots. How about the New England Patriots, that would be a little more successful.
We're talking with Glenn Stout. He's the author of the new book, The Pats. It's an illustrated history of the New England Patriots, and it's quite a colorful history indeed. You know, I'm wondering about that name change, too. I mean, maybe it was done for marketing purposes, but how long did it take for New England to become, or the Patriots to become really a New England team? I mean, are they embraced throughout the six states of New England?
I think that the Patriots actually became a New England team when Bill Parcells came here and took over as coach in 93, I believe it was. Because, you know, previous to then, a lot of old timers will recall that New England was New York Giants territory. The Giants were the closest team to New England. If you were a pro football fan, you were a Giants fan. The Giants even held their training camp over at St. Mike's. You can still talk to people who remember Frank Gifford tooling around town, sneaking out of the dormitories at night, things like that. But really, when Parcells came in and gave the team a different level of professionalism, and it also helped that he was from New York. He had been popular with the New York Giants. That's when New England began to embrace the team, because for the first time, their goal was to win championships, nothing else. Under Billy Sullivan, their goal was to stay afloat.
You know, when you think about football and the places in America where it's most revered, you immediately think of the South and Texas and Friday Night Lights and, you know, maybe out West and such. You really don't think of New England. Does New England, though, have a history of supporting and maybe even getting football going as a major sport?
Well, I mean, they tried several times. Pro football tried several times to get going in New England. They were always underfinanced. They never really had a place to play. They were always trying to play at Fenway Park, where football was kind of an odd fit. But at the lower level, the collegiate level, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, Harvard and Yale were dominant teams. And high school rivalries in New England in the 30s and 40s would sometimes draw 20,000 people to the big games between like Lowell and Lawrence or Fall River and New Bedford. So there was a lot of interest in football. It just hadn't been tapped into at the professional level.
One of the things, one of the reasons I asked about the New England embrace, I guess, of the Patriots is that we do have this comment on Twitter from Malik who says, talking about us today and this topic, isn't this a Vermont show? I realize Glenn lives in Vermont, but this topic is Massachusetts-based, he says. Boston sports supersedes state sports and athletes. Frustrating, he says. But has Vermont embrace the New England Patriots to the point where this is relevant here in this state?
Well, I think it is relevant up here. I mean, they are the New England Patriots, and although there's still some fans of other teams, what I thought was interesting this past year is even given all the success of the Red Sox, walking around town, I see more New England Patriot hats now than I see Red Sox hats. And I don't think I could have said that 10 years ago. But I think with the recent success of the Patriots, you have so many people jumping on the bandwagon, particularly younger fans who don't know about the past of the team, that I really think they have adopted that New Englandness. And it travels throughout the region now.
Yeah, winning takes care of a lot when it comes
sure
to
does.
Sports, no question. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sal on the line from Bardet. Hi, Sal.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and congratulations on the Red Sox win this year, Mitch.
I didn't do anything to make it happen. Thank you. Go on, Sal.
I was wondering, I was listening to a program called The Moth about a month ago, and they had a fascinating piece about someone talking about the magic nail. And this particular person had been injured. He gave a friend a tour of the construction of Gillette Stadium, and he got a horrible injury with that involved a nail there, and he took the nail and hit it in the stadium 1 year, and that was when the Patriots, I believe, won their first Super Bowl.
In 2001?
It may have been. I wish I could.
He should have had that nail in 1985 when the Patriots played the Bears and got blown out 46-10.
That is a cool story, Sal. Thank you very much for that call. Have you ever heard that story about that?
I heard the story when it was published or talked about a month ago, but yeah, not previous to that. No.
Amazing. So these early years with the Boston Patriots, the team really struggling, not getting a lot of great players and what have you. I would imagine that those early years, it was tough to fill the stadium, even though they didn't have yet a major home to play in.
Well, they had a small but dedicated fan base. You know, I did an event last night, and there was a fellow there who used to sell programs at Nickerson Field. You know, because even though they didn't win, there wasn't that great separation between the team and the fans that there is now.
Right.
And they were always colorful. I mean, crazy things happened. They used the nice Pat Patriot logo on the helmets.
I love that logo.
The cartoonish lineman with the tricolored hat on.
Yeah.
And that was done by Phil Bissell. And one of the great things in the book is that my collaborator, Richard Johnson, who's just a wonderful collector, he reproduces Phil Bissell's covers for all the Patriot programs through the 1960s. And they tell little stories between a Bronco for the Denver Broncos and Pat Patriot will be fighting the Bronco, things like that. They're just wonderful to look at. But, you know, even though they didn't win, there was always something interesting about them. I mean, one game, you actually had a fan on the last play of the game run onto the field. The Patriots are playing the Dallas Texans. The Texans had time for one play, and if they scored, they would win. A fan ran onto the field, set up as if he was a linebacker, was the only guy who read the play correctly, batted down the pass, ran off the field, and the Patriots won the game. The referees never noticed him. That was the kind of thing that happened to the Patriots and didn't happen to other teams.
That's
the kind of story that old-time fans, can still talk about and tell each other and remember when. Remember when before the Patriots were good, when they were funny? That's the kind of thing that the Patriots were back then.
That immediately reminds me of another great Patriots memory. It sounds very similar. They were playing a famous game against the Miami Dolphins. It was a cold New England snowy day. Neither team could score. 0-0 the whole game. Finally, the Patriots get it set up for a field goal. The only point scored in this game. And take us what happened. How they were able to kick that field goal.
Well, there was a guy named Mark Henderson who was on work release from prison, and he was operating the little snow plow, actually a snow brush that was keeping the sidelines and the markers clear. And Coach Ron Meyer of the Patriots, probably at the suggestion of Steve Grogan, waved him onto the field, and Henderson drove across the field, swept off the snow where John Smith had to line up and kick the field goal, and he was actually awarded a game ball after the game. And it actually turned around his life. He never got in trouble again.
I kind of hope he was released a little bit early from his prison cell. I'll never forget that. Now, these things do seem to happen to the Patriots. It's quite amazing. Let's move ahead a little bit, Glenn, to the 1970s now, which proved to be another mostly lost decade for the Patriots. The Boston Bruins were the darlings of the Boston sports landscape in the early part of that decade. Interest in the Red Sox had been revived since the impossible dream season of 1967. And the Celtics, they just kept on winning, even if they weren't as embraced as hardly as those other teams. How did the Pats fare in the 70s, both on the field and with fans taking an interest in them?
Well, for a brief period, there was a resurgence because they finally got a really good coach. He came from college, Chuck Fairbanks, who'd been a very, very successful collegiate coach. He brought a level of professionalism that the team hadn't had before. He was really, really good. Unfortunately, just as they started to be good, just as it looked like everybody thought they had a Super Bowl team, Chuck Fairbanks, on the precipice of the playoffs, decided, well, I'd actually like to take more money and coach the University of Colorado. Mm. So just as it seemed like the Patriots were going to get there, there's Chuck Fairbanks recruiting players for the next job he was going to take rather than coaching the Patriots. Billy Sullivan suspended him, then rehired him. And suffice to say, the Patriots lost all momentum and never won that Super Bowl in the mid-70s that people thought they were going to win.
Now, in the late 70s, didn't they have a brush with almost greatness, almost getting to the Super Bowl, a game against Oakland?
That's the famous Ben Dreith game that longtime Patriot fans still remember as kind of like the Patriots equivalent of Pesky holding the ball. Mm. But what happened was is that the Oakland Raiders were driving for a touchdown late in the game. Kenny Stabler was their quarterback. It looked like the Patriots had them stopped. He threw a pass. It went incomplete. The Patriots are going to take over. But Ben Dreith, the evil referee, called a foul on Sugar Ray Hamilton for roughing the passer. Mm. And in Patriots lore, a lot of people think that that changed everything. I take a little different look. I looked at that play from a couple of different angles. It's interesting. If you actually look at it on the field angle, it looks like he did rough the passer. If you look from above, it doesn't look quite so bad. But I would argue that there were other plays in that game that made even more of a difference. The big one being is that earlier in the game, they called on their tight end, Russ Francis, to throw a tight end option pass. Russ Francis had never thrown a pass in an NFL game before.
Otherwise, great player.
Otherwise, terrific player, but he wasn't a quarterback.
Yeah.
And he threw an interception. I would argue that that might have cost them. Otherwise, the Raiders wouldn't have had a chance to win the game.
Such an interesting connection that the Patriots seem to have with Oakland in so many different ways. I mean, Jim Plunkett, a great Oakland Raider quarterback, was a quarterback for the Pats for a while.
That's right. And Plunkett had just a terrible time with the Patriots. Of course, he was the number one pick coming out of the draft. They put everything on him. He was going to save the franchise. And they forgot one thing. They didn't have an offensive line. Hmm. And Jim Plunkett took a terrific amount of punishment in the three seasons he was the Patriots starter. I did some research. He was hit on almost 60% of every pass play. And of course, Jim Plunkett today is one of the players who's affected by post-concussion CTE syndrome and, you know, is not very healthy.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. Let's go to the calls again. Steve is on the line from East Montpelier. Hi, Steve.
How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
I have to say that your writer, that your guest hit the nail on the head about the old stadium. I was trying to reminisce about it today, and it was actually a slab that looked like the side of a hill with seats cut into it. But I went to a game with a friend who had season tickets back in the mid-70s, and I was absolutely horrified when the fans would say things like, "Go you, Patsies!" And you were absolutely right. It was a dedicated group of a small, dedicated group of fans. We froze in that place because there was no cover.
Oh, absolutely. Well, just to get to that stadium was a chore in and of itself. You'd be stuck in traffic 3 or 4 hours going in. A lot of tall boys were consumed on the highway while you were parked in traffic. And then you had the same problem getting out. I actually have a neighbor up here who lived in Massachusetts at the time. He took a bus to a game one time at the old stadium. It was so cold that he went to get a beer after the first quarter, just said the heck with it, stuck out his thumb, hitchhiked back to the North Shore of Massachusetts, and ended up watching the second half of the game from a bar while everybody else was still stuck at the stadium, freezing on those aluminum benches.
Glenn, I do want to ask about that Super Bowl year, 1985, because all that anybody remembers is how badly the Patriots got crushed in that game. They were no match at all for the Bears. Tony Eason was the quarterback. I remember that. But one thing I think people do forget is that that Patriots team was really plucky. And if I'm not mistaken, they made the Super Bowl by winning every single playoff game on the road that year.
That's right. They did. And that gave people maybe a little bit outsized sense of optimism going in against the Bears because they'd gotten there along the way. They'd squished the fish. The Miami Dolphins, who was a team they could never seem to beat during that era. And, you know, they went up against the Bears and it seemed like, well, this is their time. Well, of course, what people didn't realize at the time was the team was also torn apart by a drug scandal. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of stuff going on off the field. And you're right. They scored first. Tony Eason peaked about 2 minutes into that game. And, you know, by the end of the game, they were actually using Steve Grogan and he wasn't doing any better than Tony Eason. He didn't have a great game either. That was the Bears' year. And unfortunately, the dissension around the drug scandal with the team really cost them the opportunity to continue that level of play thereafter.
Yeah, it's too bad because they really did have a great playoff run that year. But that's all anybody remembers, of course, is the big game. Let's go to Bradford on the line from Sugar Hill, New Hampshire, I believe. Hi, Brad.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. a really old story about Patriots. In 1960, I returned from the military. I'd served in the Air Force in Europe, and I was starting summer school at UMass Amherst. A very rugged, rough, and tough bunch of thugs, looked more like people just got out of prison, were practicing on our soccer field. And I think that was one of the earliest. That was the summer of 1960-61. And I think the biggest hassle they had was they were attacking all the young co-eds. And if there had been a Me Too back then, it'd have been trouble.
Well, that was, you know, that's where the Patriots held their first couple of training camps. I think at the time they had 180 helmets, and they had to practice two or three times a day because they had so many people showing up for tryouts. And a lot of guys, even after they got cut from the team, would stick around for 3 or 4 days until somebody noticed because they were being fed every day. You didn't really have to be much of a football player to get a tryout for the Patriots at that time. But that's the kind of story I love about this book, is that, you know, you read this book and it sparks all those old memories from old-time fans. And we also provide for more fans of more recent vintage who only know the Patriots as winners. We give them a sense of the history of the team that they're now fans of. You know, they went from laughingstock to dynasty, and there's a reason that happened. There's a how and a why. I always try to answer, you know, why and how did they win when they won? Why and how did they lose when they lost? And why do people care so much about them? And, you know, you just say the Patriots now, and everybody has their own story they want to tell about it.
Why do people care so much about the Patriots?
Well, I think, you know, because they've grown up with them. You know, it was when if you're an old time fan, you were one of the true believers. You know, you were really one of the true believers. Now, of course, it's a little different because you want to get on the bandwagon. Yeah. You want to celebrate with your friends. I mean, one of the things I say is, you know, you have all these kids that come to Boston and New England to go to college, and they're from Pittsburgh and they're from Baltimore or somewhere else, and they're wearing a Ravens jersey or they got a Steelers shirt. They come back and they have Super Bowl logos tattooed on their arms. You know, it changes really quick when all of a sudden you realize you're with a winner.
Carl is on the line from Cornwall. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Mitch. I'm an old school Pats fan.
Excellent.
And you should have Glenn Stout on once a week.
Oh, I would love to. Believe me, you know, if we could find a way to make that happen, I would.
Baseball season. Anyway, I go way back, and I love this early, and I love these stories that you're telling about the early Pats. But I remember watching. In Lewiston, Maine, I'd watch a lot of hockey in the youth center there where Muhammad Ali knocked out Sonny Liston. And there was a player that came down every winter named Butch Songin.
Oh, sure.
And he was a quarterback for the Pats.
He was the Patriots' first quarterback, but he was better known as a hockey player. Hmm. He'd been a terrific hockey player in college, but he'd played a lot of semi-pro football. And when the Patriots first started, he had more experience than anybody else they could get. He was a tough guy.
Carl, do you...
I saw him play hockey.
Yeah, Carl, I'm wondering if as a longtime Patriots fan, do you sort of take an extra ownership of the success they've had in these recent years and, you know, tell younger folks, hey, you guys don't remember when they were terrible?
Oh, no, I'm not that bad. You know, I enjoy this, but I do remember Butch Songin, and he had brothers, and they were tough guys. And, you know, played with Jim Nance. I believe he probably was on that team. Maybe even Gino Cappelletti when
Gino was...
kickers were also important players on the field.
Yeah, Gino was certainly there.
I guess the point I would make is that the idea that the football players, living in ease, making a lot of money and living easy. Here's this guy playing semi-pro hockey all winter long and then going to play for the Patriots. To me, it's representative of that era, you know, and all of the, you know, and how... rough and tough it probably was.
He gave up his job working as a parole officer to play quarterback for the Patriots, and they shaved 5 years off his age so it wouldn't seem like he was this old guy.
Amazing. Thanks for the call very much, Carl. Let's go to Tom in Barry. Hi, Tom. You're on Vermont Edition with Glenn Stout.
Hi. How are you all? I really appreciate the reminiscence of listening to both of you. When I was a young lad, I saw the Pats play at Fenway Park with my dad first game ever against the Kansas City Chiefs. Houston Antoine was the guard and promised that I could go to the locker room if they won the game. Well, being young, first play Matt Caron ran one back, and you know, needless to say, they lost, and I never got to go into the locker room. But, you know, about a couple weeks later, I got a letter from Houston Antoine apologizing for the loss and not being able to take me down there, you know, meet Babe Parilli, like, and Gino Cappelletti, who did all the kicking as well. But I do remember my dad, he sold life insurance in the Boston area and utilized Houston Antoine during the off season, from what I recall, would bring him around and introduce him to folks, hoping that they would buy life insurance utilizing Houston Antoine. Now, I'm not sure if he ever took up that as a profession in the off season, because I don't think they got paid very much.
No, probably not. Thanks for the call, Tom.
That's a great story, because I think what it points out is that the early years of the Patriots, the fans could be so much closer to the players.
Yeah.
We have a wonderful photograph that Richard found in the book of fans watching the Patriots practice, and there's a kid on his bicycle about 6 inches off the edge of the field, and there's another kid that's on his dad's shoulders, and, you know, you could have been knocked over. But back then, there wasn't that big separation between the fans and the players. They were just another guy in the neighborhood, and they did interact with the fans in just the way he described. And Gino Cappelletti, he mentioned, if there's anybody that deserves to be called Mr. Patriot, it's Gino. Joined the team as a defensive back and a kicker, became a wide receiver, led the AFL in scoring through much of the 1960s, and then became very beloved as a broadcaster. I think he should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. The Pro Football Hall of Fame disagrees, but if there's anybody that deserves to be there who isn't, it's Mr. Patriot Gino Cappelletti.
It's hard to believe he's not in the Hall of Fame. It really actually is. I want to jump ahead, of course, to now getting to the years of success with the New England Patriots, and there was a lot of hope when Bill Parcells came to coach the team. He'd already had so much success with the New York Giants. He comes in, he doesn't stay very long, but he does get to the Pats to a Super Bowl.
Yeah, he changed the whole tenor of the franchise. You know, he'd taken the Giants to the Super Bowl. He'd been a success. Then he had a little bit of heart trouble, when it got out of coaching for a few years, got the clean bill of health, and was hired to coach the Pats. What really took place when Bill joined the team was he was there for one reason, to win a championship.
Mm-hmm.
And he told everybody, and I know how to do it. The other thing is that for the first time, you had somebody else other than Billy Sullivan who was the face of the franchise. The buck stopped with Bill Parcells. He controlled the press like puppets. You know, Bill didn't have a small ego. He liked to say, you are what you are. You are what your record says.
Mm-hmm.
And people really responded to him in New England because he just told it like it was. You know, Billy Sullivan kind of spoke out of both sides of his mouth. Everything was great, even when you knew it wasn't. Bill Parcells just told you what was happening. And I really think you can break Patriots history down into two halves, before Parcells and after Parcells, because the expectations were entirely different and have remained entirely different ever since.
Yeah. And even though they did not win the Super Bowl under Parcells, they lost to the Green Bay Packers. There was a bad breakup. There's that famous quote where Bill Parcells, he was angry that he wasn't getting to choose the players. He says, if they're going to ask you to cook the meal, they you know, might as well let you buy the groceries or something of that
effect.
Right,
right. That was the whole Christian Peter incident, where the Patriots drafted Christian Peter, who had a real checkered past as a collegiate player, and Myra Kraft, Bob Kraft's wife, essentially told him to release him because she didn't want somebody with that kind of baggage. He'd been involved in some sexual assaults on the team. Parcells took real umbrage at the owner's wife getting involved in who he could play and who he couldn't.
But then a Bill Parcells protege, Bill Belichick, comes on to coach the team. And then Robert Kraft has bought the team. And then a guy named Tom Brady gets to play because Drew Bledsoe, the star quarterback at the time, got hurt. You ever think, what if he hadn't?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if Mo Lewis hadn't almost torn Drew Bledsoe in half when he tackled him along the sideline, you have to wonder if Tom Brady ever would have received a chance with the Patriots. You know, Dick Rabine, who was their quarterback coach and scouted Brady, thought that he was going to be great. No one else really did. He was the 199th draft pick. I think at most they hoped that this was a guy they might develop and maybe they could trade him because people would think he was good. I don't think they ever thought he would have to play. But they were really smart with him because when Brady came in and took over at quarterback, and I think this is true over the course of his career, they haven't asked him to do more than he can. They've adapted their offense to what he could do. early on, he wasn't asked to do very much. Throw a lot of really simple, short passes, control the football, get first downs. You don't have to throw the ball 60 yards. And over the entire course of his career, they've stuck to that philosophy of just having Brady do what Brady can do. It's also helped that over the entire course of Brady's career, there have been a subtle set of rule changes that have taken place that means that he doesn't have to take the punishment that Jim Plunkett had. I think Jim Plunkett got hit more times in 3 years that he was the quarterback of the Patriots than Tom Brady has in almost 20.
Yeah, a lot of people would say that Brady was greatly helped by the Tuck rule at the time.
That certainly helped him at one point.
Well, in 2001. Crawdad is on the line from Bennington. Hi, Crawdad.
How are you doing?
Doing all right.
I'd like to know if, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Absolutely, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm wondering if Tom Brady's going to go for another 2 years in the NFL.
All right. Let's have Glenn ask that question. We're short on time.
Well, I think if the Patriots, keep an offensive line that can keep people off of him, I don't think there's any reason why Brady can't continue. You know, in the NFL right now, there's a lot of quarterbacks who've played for a long time. Drew Brees, for one, he's another quarterback who's benefited from the changes in the rules that have made the passing game more successful and also kept the quarterback from being hit as much. I wouldn't be surprised if Brady plays another couple years.
Jim is on the line from Panton, Vermont. Hi, Jim. We're a little bit short on time, but we'd love to take your call. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. This isn't exactly about the Patriots, but it is about football in Vermont history. Back in around 1957, the New York Giants did work out over there at St. Michael's College, and my mom used to pick the guys up at the nightclubs at 10 o'clock and take them back to the campus while they weren't allowed out late at night. And one night, she brought three of the players. I was only around 7 years old, over to the house, and I got to meet Charlie Connolly and Kyle Rhoda and that big fellow, that Roosevelt Greer.
Wow,
who was a huge Indian.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool! Wow, Jim, thank you for that call. I mean, this was at a time when, can you imagine that? These guys practicing right over at St. Michael's College down the road from us.
Yeah, and I can't imagine mom bringing home Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, and, Josh Gordon right now.
Glenn, I want to ask you in the brief time that we have left here, because a lot of I will hear, I love getting into sports arguments with folks, and it's just fun, but a lot of people get really angry when they talk about the Patriots. They're not fans of the Pats, and they say things like, they only won that Super Bowl because of Spygate or because of Deflategate, things like that. I mean, what do you address in the book about some of those controversies?
Well, we address all the controversies in here. One of our goals in writing this book, or all the books we've done together, is we don't write Valentines. We treat history as a real subject. We tell the real story of the team. We try to tell, warts and all. You have to admit that at times the Patriots have pushed the envelope. Bill Belichick is all about winning. He's also not afraid sometimes to cross the line a little bit. Just because he's a great winning coach doesn't mean necessarily that he's morally perfect, So I think you have to respect your audience too. Patriot fans know that. They know that they've, teased things and pushed a little bit farther than they should have sometimes. They don't need to be given like a Hallmark card about the Patriots. And I think that's one of the reasons why, on Christmas morning, we hope we see this book underneath a lot of Christmas trees, because it's the kind of book, yes, it's a coffee table book because it has beautiful pictures in it, but there's also so much to read, so much to re-experience. And as we've experienced with our callers today, sparks so many memories, whether you've been following the team for 50 years, whether you've been following the team to 5. And that's how we all get to know each other, is through our stories. And in New England, that's one of the things that knits this team to the region, is that everybody can tell a story about the Patriots.
That's why this book is so amazing. And, in another 50 years, you're going to have people reminiscing about the glories of the Brady days, in the Belichick days. And they'll be saying, this was the greatest football team you've ever seen. Wonderful stuff.
That's right.
I wish we had more time with it. Glenn Stout is co-author with Richard Johnson of the new book, The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. Glenn, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. I'll be at North Shire Books tonight. Come out and see us.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Tonight at North Shire Bookstore in Manchester at 5:30. Find out more details at vpr.net.